much. I call your attention to the book of Amos. I began 2 weeks ago going through what I'm titling the series, The Other 12. We began with Hosea, then we talked about Joel last week. And today we're going to talk about Amos. Amos the prophet. I must admit that I have a fond place in my heart for this man. He's one of the few Amoses that I'm familiar with. I know Amos Moses. He was a Cajun. He lived by himself in the swamp and hunted alligators for a living, just hit him in the head with a stump. I know him. And some of you other heathen know him. I also know famous Amos. I like his cookies. For those of you that love baseball, you may remember a fellow that played center field for the Kansas City Royals named Amos Otis. For 13 years, he played for the Royals. He stole 5 bases in one game one time. That's pretty good. The reason I guess I have the affection for this Amos is because it was either late fall or early winter of 1973. Now I know for these young people that was way back when dinosaurs roamed the earth. All right? But I remember that because it was the first sermon that I ever preached. I was asked to speak at a preacher boys club. We called it the Billy Sunday Club. I'd never preached a message in my life. I didn't know how to prepare a sermon. I had no idea. I mean, I believed that God was probably calling me to preach, but I was scared to acknowledge that call because I'd seen so many young men acknowledge that call and then turn their back on it and start living in a life of sin. And I never wanted to open my mouth and say I will do something if I wasn't going to follow through on it. And so I was asked to speak at this Billy Sunday Club, and I thought, well, I got to find a sermon. So what I did was I went to the Baptist bookstore. They call it Lifeway now, but way back in that dispensation, it was the Baptist bookstore. Of course, it was pre-internet days. All right, and so I went and I'd walk through the different racks of books, and I came across an evangelist named Herschel Ford. Herschel Ford has been dead. As a matter of fact, he may have been dead when I got this book. He was an evangelist from the early part to the middle part of the 1970s. Well, there was a book that he had published, and it was Evangelistic Themes. And so I thought, I can afford it. It was a skinny book. So I bought this book, and as I was thumbing through this, this one little sermon kept captivating my mind, and I thought, I can steal that one. And it came out of Amos chapter 4, verse 12, and the little phrase is, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. Now I'm going to tell you, the night that I preached that message, I was styling and profiling. All right? I had on a red blazer. I had on a sweater vest. I had on a polyester shirt that had stripes in it. I had flared pants with a 2-inch cuff that we liked to wear way back then, and I had 3-tone stacked shoes. Any of you guys remember stacked shoes? All right, 4 of you, all right. I had a tie on with a knot that would have choked a horse. I mean, that was a huge knot. There was a 7-point outline, and I promise you, as God is my witness, I preached it in less than 5 minutes. And that was with a long illustration at the end. I remember fondly what a mess I made. And I hope, I hope I've gotten a little better over the last 40 years. But I'm telling you, Amos has been a favorite book of mine from that time forward. Now, I didn't really understand it until a few years ago. And to be honest with you, it's still unfolding even in my mind, even this morning. But as I began to understand history, and I began to understand the times in which Amos lived, things began to kind of solidify in my mind, and I'm hoping to be able to do this for you a little bit this morning. I want us to just kind of think about this. Amos was a farmer. He preached in the north. But look with me at verse number 1 of chapter 1. It says about Amos, he said, he was among the herdmen of Tekoa. Well, what is the herdman? Well, he was a keeper of sheep and cattle. He did something else I'm going to show you in a second. But he was from a place called Tekoa. Now, there's a different spelling of it that we have here in our state. But if you go from here over to Interstate 85 heading toward Greenville, you'll pass an exit that says Tekoa. The spelling is changed, but if you keep going back and back and back, I'd bet you a dollar to a donut that the Tekoa over in the eastern part of our state, I bet that it is a rendition of the Tekoa that's in the Bible. Because you see, there's a lot of cities that are named after things in the Bible, just like there are people that are named after people in the Bible. And so what do you have? You've got a man that is from Tekoa. I want you to see chapter 7. I want you to look with me at what it says about him in verse 14. He's being accused, he's being criticized, and he's basically being run out of town, if that were possible, which it was not, by a man named Amaziah. And Amaziah was the head priest at a place called Bethel or Bethel. Bethel was the capital of the pagan religions in the northern part of Israel. Now, Tekoa was not in the north. Tekoa was in Judah. It was in the south. As a matter of fact, it was about 6 miles from Bethlehem. That is where David, when David was just a little shepherd boy, 200 or 300 years before Amos comes along. You've got a little teenage boy, and what's he doing? He's roaming the hillsides below Bethlehem, around Tekoa, and that's where David was grazing his sheep. And now Amos is a farmer in that area. And what does he do? Well, look at verse 14. I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was a herdman, and I was a gatherer of sycamore fruit. When you look at that word herdman there, it comes from a Hebrew word which means that he raised sheep. And it's a special kind of sheep. It has to do with a little smaller variety of sheep that are spotted. And so you've got him and he's raising a certain type of sheep that maybe people prefer as opposed to the larger variety. I guess it would be similar to people that raise horses. Some people like to raise the big ones, and some people raise the little ones like Shetland ponies. And so he's got a small variety of spotted sheep, But he's not limited to that. He has some cows. That's referenced over in chapter 4, which we're not going to go to. I'll reference that here in a few minutes. But he also, if you'll notice, that he was a gatherer of sycamore fruit. Now, when we think of a sycamore tree, we think of a tall tree that drops little balls. When I was a kid growing up, in the fall, when those balls would begin to drop, we would take our foot, usually with a pair of tennis shoes or a pair of boots on, and we would take those balls and we would grind it onto the dirt, filling all of those little crevices with dirt. And then we would pick them up and throw them at each other. Typical boy, all right? That is not the sycamore tree that's in Israel. The sycamore tree that is in Israel is similar to what we would classify as like wild figs. It would be something that poor people would use. Now, he would cultivate these. If you see that, he says he was a gatherer. That meant that what he was doing is at certain times of the year when this little fruit, fig-looking fruit would begin to grow, you would have to pierce it or nip it. And the reason for that is if you didn't pierce it or nip it, it would get so hard that it was not edible. And so he knew how to cultivate that fruit, and he would sell that as a cash crop. He was probably not a wealthy man. He was just a guy making a living, raising some spotted sheep, raising a few cows, and gathering fruit just to make ends meet. You say, well, preacher, why do you say he wasn't a wealthy man? Because a lot of times, whenever you have a prophet that's mentioned, it'll mention his daddy. There's no mention at all of Amos's father. As a matter of fact, the book of Amos is the only book that has this man's name in it. I mean, you can read the whole Bible, and this is the only book in which he is mentioned. And so, you've got him, and he's coming from the south, and all of a sudden, God says, I want you to go preach up north. Now, let me tell you what this would be like. This would be like a guy coming from Cobbtown, Georgia, going to Atlanta and preaching on the steps of the Capitol. Now, some of you know where Cobbtown's at. There's one light in town. It's close to Collins, which has a flashing light in town. You say, well, how do you know about those places? Because my mama lives down there. All right? I mean, you've got a couple of little towns that are about 5 miles from each other, and when you go through it, you don't have to always slow down, only certain times of the year when they have a policeman. It's just, I'm talking about, it is a hick town. Tekoa is just like that. So you got this guy from the country. And what is he doing? He's going up to Bethel, which is in Samaria, which is the northern half of the division. They don't want him there. They don't want this guy coming to their town, especially when he starts preaching. And so this morning, what I want us to look at is I want us to look at three key phrases, and I want you to then look with me as we go through the oracles or the judgments that he preaches against these folks. One of the key phrases is this: for three transgressions and for four. Now, in my Bible, what I have done is I have underlined each one of these phrases with a different color highlighter. I have green here for this particular one, for three transgressions and for four. That doesn't mean that there was one, two, three, and four. What it is it's an Hebrew idiom. It's a poetic way of saying that God is done His wrath is full up. His cup is running over. Enough is enough. That is what is being said. They have sinned and they have sinned and they have sinned. And so you've got that as one of the phrases. It's found in chapter 1, chapter 2, which is predominantly where we're going to hang out today. Then there's a second little phrase. I will kindle a fire. In other words, because you have sinned these sins, I will send judgment upon you. And we find that in chapter 1 and chapter 2. And then there's a third phrase. And this is predominantly found in chapter 4. And he says this, yet you have not returned unto me. And he preaches these oracles. Then he preaches some sermons. And then he tells them about visions. And the last thing that he gives them is he gives them hope with a promise from God. And so I want us to look quickly this morning. I want you to see, first of all, the oracles about the nations of the Gentile nations. Look with me at chapter 1 in verse 3. He said, thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Damascus. And I want you to notice the different groups of people that he is referencing. Damascus, which is modern day Syria, right? And for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have threshed Gilead with threshing instruments of iron. What they had done is this, they had stepped over from Syria into the northeast part of the nation of Israel, and they had taken people captive. And to show the brutality, to strike fear in the hearts of people, they had tied people to the ground, and they would run threshing machines across them with animals, basically cutting the people into ribbons. They were brutal in their treatment of these people that they had conquered. And so, because of that, God told him in verse 4, I will send a fire to you. In other words, judgment is coming to Damascus. Now remember, where's he preaching? He's preaching in Israel. He's up north. And they're going, amen, preacher, I like that. Get them Syrians. Tell them about it. Well, then he goes to another one. Look with me at verse 6. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Gaza. Now, what is Gaza? It is called Philistia. If you begin to read, you'll read about the places called Ashdod and Ekron. Those are Philistine cities. Well, what had they been doing? They had been taking God's people and they had been selling them as slaves. They had come in, they would get people, they would lead them into captivity, and then they would say, hey, there's some Grecians over here, let's sell them to the Greeks. And the next thing you know, they're on a boat, they're going across the Mediterranean, never to be heard from again. Why? Because they've been sold. And what does God say? Verse 7, I'll send a fire to the wall of Gaza. Well, what about the next one? Look at verse number 9. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Tyrus, or Tyre, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. They delivered up the whole captivity of Edom. In other words, they went down into the southern part of Israel. They captured whole groups of people, and they sold them into slavery. Well, look with me at verse number 11. There's another group of people that God said judgment's coming to. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Edom, and for four. Now, who is Edom? Do you remember way back in the book of Genesis when you had a lady named Rachel, and she had, no, it wasn't Rachel, it was Rebecca. Rebecca had two boys. They were twins. You had one that was Esau and you had one that was Jacob. Jacob, even though he was the second one to exit the womb, he became the one that would be the chosen lineage of the seed of Messiah. Edom would be the offspring of Esau. Well, what had happened during that time? Do you remember Jacob was constantly fleeing? He was going where? Down to his uncle Laban's house to get away from his brother because his brother was trying to kill him. And so, if you look at Edom, what does he say? Because he did pursue his brother with the sword. In other words, Esau tried to get Jacob with the sword. And may I say that here we are now, hundreds and hundreds of years later, and his offspring still have that same mindset. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to tear those people apart. And the Bible says in verse 11, they did it perpetually. And he kept his wrath forever. So you've got Edom, and what is he doing? He's trying to hurt his cousins. Now, I've got cousins that don't exactly agree with me on a lot of things. I've got cousins of all different stripes and persuasions. But can I tell you, I've never wanted a single one of them to have something bad happen to them. But that's not the case here. Man, these Edomites, they were trying to take the people that were considered to be God's people, and they were trying basically to just murder them. And so you've got Edom. Well, look with me at verse 13. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of the children of Ammon, and for four. Well, who's Ammon? Do you remember the story of Lot? And God said, you need to get out of Sodom. His wife turned and looked back and turned to a pillar of salt. He took his two daughters. They go, I guess, fleeing away from the fire and the brimstone that's falling on Sodom and Gomorrah. And they end up going and living in a cave, basically. And the girls are thinking, wow, we're never going to get a chance to get married. And so what do? They get a plan together. And they decide, let's get our dad drunk. And if we get him drunk, he won't really recognize us. He'll just know we're women. And so one night, one of the girls goes in, and she gets pregnant by her own father. Day or so later, they get him drunk again. The other girl goes in, she gets pregnant. One of those was named Ammon. That's who we're talking about here, the offspring of that incestuous relationship. What was Ammon doing? Look at verse 13. Because they have ripped up the women, the pregnant women, with child that were in Gilead. And what's the reason? That they might enlarge their border. In other words, they are trying to have a genocide. Why? Because they want the land of Gilead. What does God say? I'll kindle a fire in the wall of Rahab, and it shall devour the palaces thereof with the shouting in the day of battle, with the tempest in the day of the whirlwind. The king's going to go into captivity. And so you've got Ammon. Look at verse 1 of chapter 2. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Moab, and for four. Who is Moab? That's the other boy that was born in that incestuous relationship of the second daughter that Lot had with his daughters. What did they do? Well, they were fighting against Edom. And their hatred was so great that after they had the king killed, and he was buried, they dug his body up, and they burned him so much with fervent heat that his bones turned into lime. That is the hatred, the revenge that the Moabites had. And so you've got these people of Israel, and they're saying, go get them, preacher. You tell them, heathen, God's coming. That's what they're saying. They're like, man, they like this message. I mean, they like it that Syria is going down. They like it that the Philistines are going down. They like it that those of Tyre, those of Edom, those that are of Moab and Ammon, they like it that those guys are going to have the judgment of God fall on them. But then he begins to close the net a little bit. If you begin to look at the different people, I mean, he starts up north, he goes down south, he comes over to the east, he comes to the west a little bit, and you can almost visualize a noose coming closer and closer and closer. And I mean, you telling people that are getting drunk, preacher, but don't talk about me and my gossiping. You tell them young people that are fornicating, but don't talk about us senior citizens. You know, you tell all of those other people, but don't be getting on mine. You know, I mean, I got some pet ones. Well, what does God say through the prophet? Look with me at verse 4. Thus saith the Lord. This is chapter 2, verse 4. He says, for three transgressions of Judah. Ooh. Judah. Those are those guys that are right down there next to Jerusalem. Well, that's okay. I mean, we're up here. And so what is he doing? He's talking about somebody that's close, but it's still not us yet. And so when you begin to look at the transgressions of Judah, what were they doing? Were they burning people's bones? Does it say they were selling people into slavery? Does it say that they were tying people to the ground and threshing them just like they would do some cash crop? Oh, no, 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 no. What you have is the first six people that God judges, those Gentile nations, it's probably because of the way that they treated other people. God wants people to be treated justly. God wants people to not be maligned and used and stepped on. You say, well, we don't really have a lot of problems with slavery. We don't in this country. But I'm going to tell you something. There's still slavery going on all around this globe. You've got it in certain countries in Africa. You've got it in certain countries in the Middle East. You've got it in Islamic places. And you've got that is still going on to this day. And it doesn't matter if it was here 200 years ago or if it's somewhere now. Currently, God is not in favor of that. And so you've got these people, and they're all jazzed about God taking care of those Gentiles. And they're not really liking it now that Judah is kind of bringing it a little closer to home. I mean, they're in our neighborhood now. And what does God say that he's ticked off with them about? Well, they've despised the law of God. You say, well, what does that mean? That means that they knew what the law was. But I'm just not going to do it. I mean, I know what the commandments are, but I'm just not going to keep it. I mean, after all, I mean, I've got my liberty. I can do whatever I want to. It doesn't matter what God's book says. Well, people that make statements like that are guilty of the exact same thing that these people in Judah were guilty of. They've not kept his commandments, and their lies have caused them to err. And then he begins to really get it to where he's stepping on their toes now. Remember, where is he preaching? He's preaching in Bethel, the capital of the Samaritans. I mean, that's where all of their pagan rituals are going on. Oh, now they're saying that it's for God. But the truth of the matter is, all through Mount Carmel, on every one of the hills, under all of the trees, they've got all of these little altars built to Baal. They've got all of these pagan altars that are built to the goddess Ashtarte. And they go, oh, but we're worshiping God. No, you're worshiping the pagans. And so God says in verse 6, For three transgressions in Israel, and four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. And why? Well, I believe that there's probably three or four things. First of all, there's greed. Look with me at verse 7 and verse 8. They that pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor and turn aside the way of the meek. Panting after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor, most people think that that is a reference to the fact that they even try to get the ground that the poor people are walking on, they even try to get that under their power just so that there's total ability to manipulate, total ability to get, even from the poorest. Look with me at verse 8. And they lay themselves down upon clothes laid to pledge by every altar. They were taking people that were really down and out. And they would offer them money as like a lending institution. And what they would do is they would say, basically they were a modern day pawn shop, all right? And people would come by and they would say, well, I mean, we need to get some money. And these are brothers now, brothers and sisters. And what are they doing? They're saying, we don't have any money to feed our kids. We don't have a home for our family to live in. I don't have a place to sleep. And a lot of these people were basically living rough. And some of them would have an outer coat, and that was all they had. And yet, you would have a wealthy lender, and they would look at them and they would say, oh, well, I'll give you 5 shekels for your coat. And then you can come pay me later. But do you know what God had commanded in the book of Deuteronomy? He said, don't you take a man's coat for money if that is all he's got to cover up with at night. In other words, just imagine this. You're living under a bridge. And some guy goes, could you loan me $5? You say, give me your coat. And then you take that coat and just leave the guy on a cold night, and he's out there with nothing to cover up with. That's what these people were doing. There was no compassion whatsoever. Can I tell you, if this church knew of one of our members, if we knew that they did not have food, we'd get them some food. If they needed a coat, we'd buy a coat. We've had some bus kids that we were told that we're going into winter and these kids don't have a coat. They've outgrown the one they've been wearing now for 3 years. And you see them come in, I mean, it's 20 degrees and these kids coming in with a t-shirt on. Well, if we know they need that, you know what we're going to do? We're going to find somebody that'll say, hey, I'll buy a coat. Somebody else will say, well, I'll buy a coat. And the next thing you know, we got somebody that's got some coats. But not these folks. It was all about greed. But not only that, there was lust. Look at verse 7, the latter part. A man and his father will go in unto the same maid. In other words, it was a prostitute, and a man goes and has his way with her, and he goes back to his dad and said, "Hey, man, she's good, Dad. You ought to try her out." That's the wickedness that you've got going on in the nation of Israel. And God basically sends Amos to say, "I'm not putting up with it." Not only that, but look with me at verse 12. There's some defrauding that's going on. What is defrauding in a New Testament sense? Do you remember over in the New Testament, I think it's in Thessalonians, where it says, don't defraud your brother in Christ? You know what that means? That means you don't stir up unrighteous desires in a brother or sister. Don't put them in a situation where they're going to be tempted and fall. But yet, in verse 12, you've got a group of people called Nazarites. John the Baptist was a Nazarite. You're not supposed to drink alcohol. Samson was a Nazarite. They don't always cut their hair. Why? Because it's a Nazarite vow and it makes them look different, so everybody goes, something different about that guy. But what are they doing? But you gave the Nazarites wine to drink. And you commanded the prophet, saying, prophesy not. A Nazarite is supposed to be different. A prophet is supposed to be different. And what are you doing? If a prophet's trying to preach, you're saying, shut up. A Nazarite's not supposed to drink. Hey, buddy, drink this. And the next thing you know, the guy's drunk as a coot. Why? Because he's been defrauded by these people. And so God says, yeah, I'm going to judge the Gentiles. But I got news for you, Judah. It's coming for you. And I got news for you, Israel. It's really coming for you. And Israel was more wicked than Judah was. Hence, Judah came into captivity 150 years roughly after the north went into captivity. But old Amos, he was a preacher that just loved God. Now, when it says that he was no prophet, he was no prophet's son. What that means is he was not a product of a Bible college. Now, this does not mean that we denigrate Bible colleges. If you're called to preach, you ought to have a call to prepare on your life. But there are some people that God touches and they don't go to school. I think they're few and far between. Spurgeon was a man like that. He just had the mind that was just gifted from God. And there's a few other preachers here and there that we could name, like a John Bunyan, a Curtis Hudson, those types of guys. Amos is among that lot. He didn't go to a school that was established by Elijah or Elisha. He didn't go to a Bible college that Samuel started. No, he's just minding his own business. He's taking care of some sheep, and he's nipping some fruit whenever it comes time to nip it. Why? So that the poor people can have a little bit of joy in their life eating these wild figs. And so what do you have? You got a preacher that's just being faithful. Now this morning, what's some of the takeaways? You can see on the screen, the first thing is that God is in charge of the whole world. Sometimes we have people and we think, man, our country is so big. We are so strong. We are so powerful that we're never, ever going to fall. Can you not just hear echoes of that in the Roman Empire? Can you not hear echoes of that in the Grecian Empire with Alexander the Great? Can you not hear Nebuchadnezzar saying, I'm God on this earth. Let's make me an image. And what does God do? God takes him out, and he's out in the pasture clawing around with long fingernails, long hair. And what's he doing? He's eating grass like a cow. Why? Because God sets nations up, and God takes nations down. And it doesn't matter if it's the United States of America or if it's ancient Syria. God is in control of everything. Not only that, let me give you a second thing. We have a duty to obey God and to stand for right. When you look at Amos, he just did what he was supposed to do. He said, I'm out there minding my own business. If you look at chapter 7, it's a funny phrase for me. He was just following. If you look at verse 15, I mean, he's just walking around chasing some sheep. And the Lord took me. I mean, he just took me. You may be walking around one day just minding your own business, and God may say, I want you. And you got something to do. Why? Because God's telling you to do it. There's some of you that may be sitting here this morning, and God may take you and stick you in a Sunday school class. God may take you and stick you in a choir. God may take you and stick you on a mission field. God may take you and put you visiting nursing homes. God could take you and do all kind of things. He could give you 1,000 different ways to go, and he would say, this is your way, and the other 999, that's their way. But he was taken just out there minding his own business. Well, when we have that, we have a duty to obey. Why? Because we name the name of God. Let me give you a third one. We should have the courage to stand in the face of opposition. Well, if you look at chapter 7, what you'll find is, oh, Amaziah, he's saying, why don't you go back to the land of Judah? Why don't you get on back to Tekoa? We don't want you here. And he looks at him and he goes, I was no prophet. Hey, I didn't come out of some Bible college. My daddy wasn't even a prophet. But God took me and he told me to come here, and so you can like it, lump it, or bump it. And that's pretty much what he told him. And so we ought to have the courage to stand in the face of opposition. Number four, God uses ordinary people. You don't get much more ordinary than a sheep care or sheep herder and a cow rustler. You know? I mean, how common is it, you know, for somebody to just work on a farm? It's pretty common in ancient times. Now, we're an industrial society more so now, and really kind of a computer society now. But at one time, it was all agriculture. I mean, if somebody had a tractor, there's people they'd just gather just to watch the thing drive. Most of them were like, well, I'd like to have one of those. All I got's two mules. You ain't got to feed that tractor. Just put a little gas in it. When the Industrial Revolution came along, it began to change our society. But I'm going to tell you, up until really about the 1930s, I mean, it was pretty much all agriculture. It was agrarian. Well, in ancient times, that's what it was. And one of the most common things that a man could do would be work on a farm. And that's where you've got Amos. God uses ordinary people. He takes guys that work construction. He takes women that work in cafeterias. He takes men that works on high rises and maybe put buildings together. He takes ladies that work in offices. He takes people wherever you're at. And he says, you're mine, this is your job. God uses ordinary people. We ought to be willing, when God touches us, when God takes us, to be used. Let's stand together.